the Nightlife podcast.
CJ Johnson, a big part of the Nightlife family since the days of Mr. Delroy, of course, and we really enjoy having him along on a Saturday for a deep dive into a few topics. I've had a few of these chats with CJ before, and I always look forward to them. CJ, welcome back.
Thank you, Dom. Lovely to speak to you again.
So this is part two of the list, which when it was embarked upon, the 1970s in Australian film, it proved so enticing that you needed a second bite at it.
Yes, and we should do a bit of a quick recap of the films we covered so that listeners don't call in and say, how come you haven't mentioned so on? Those listeners who might not have been listening last time. The idea was that we'd cover the 70s in Australian cinema because not a lot happened in Australian cinema before the 1970s. And we only got halfway because there was so much discussion. So we discussed last time Walkabout, Wake in Fright, The Adventures of Barry McKenzie and its sequel, Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, The Cars That Ate Paris, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and we concluded with The Man from Hong Kong. So some astounding classics and some intriguing films and just some fun films as well. Mm. But we only got to 1975, so it was actually a perfect halfway point.
You were dismissed in 1975, in other words, which was a thing that happened a bit in those days. If you've got a favourite 70s film that you want to talk about, unless they're one of those that have been covered already, I'm not especially fussed if it's from the first half of the decade. As long as we haven't embarked upon it before, we don't want to do the whole Wake in Fright tribute again. I presume that was a big part of the last conversation, CJ, Wake in Fright being the iconic movie that it is. But if there's another movie from the 70s from Australia that we need to mention or you have a connection to and involvement with some of the films we do discuss, please pick up the phone, 1-300-800-222. Give us a call or send a text, 0467-922-702. And join the conversation. I hope to hear from lots of people tonight, particularly those who were around watching things in the 70s and getting excited about it. There was a film that we actually talked about a few weeks ago when I was filling in called Morning of the Earth, which was a surf movie, an iconic surf movie back then. And I know a lot of listeners enjoyed that. So maybe someone will ring up and tell us about Morning of the Earth, which was really a pioneering surf film. So much to get through, CJ, but you have curated a fabulous list for us for the 70s in Australian film. And we look at perhaps the only film on the list that is still regularly screened in cinemas around the world today.
Yeah, well, we're going to start with a cheat. The first film we're going to talk about, strictly speaking, you wouldn't call it an Australian film. So as the president of the Film Critics Circle of Australia, we occasionally have to decide whether or not a film is, quote unquote, an Australian film, because we have to decide whether it's eligible for our awards. And so over the years, we've come up with a point system. And so, you know, if the director's Australian, that's so many points. And if the story is Australian, that's so many points. And if the money comes from Australia, that's so many points. And on the basis of that, the film I'm about to talk about would not be considered an Australian film. It was shot in England. The money was American and English. It was written by a British New Zealander. Most of the cast is British or American, but it was directed by an Australian, and that Australian also directed the stage show on which it's based, and he developed the stage show with the British New Zealand writer.
That's all
so
I need to hear.
So it is very much an auteurist work by that director, and it is, of course, Dom.
Of course, it is the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And
absolutely, Jim Sharman's Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes, and what, little Nell was Australian, wasn't she? There's some Australian connections in there. Australians enjoy it. It's an Australian film.
She was Australian. Jim Sharman was Australian, and he's got to be considered, you know, 45% of the whole pie.
Yeah.
And then Brian Thompson designed the stage production and the movie. And Brian Thompson is Australian. I believe he still lives in Sydney. And so Jim Sharman and Brian Thompson, really, they were a huge creative part of this thing, because this thing, besides being, you know, very directed, as it were, is very designed. When you think of that film, you think of the sets and the costumes and the world that it creates. And also, I think that film, has a bit of an Australian sensibility, a bit of a 70s Australian sensibility. I think it's, you know, it's camp and flamboyant and brash and exuberant, and the sense of humour, I think, is outrageous.
Well, and yes, we can certainly say very antipodean, I think, in terms of simply no respect for the status quo, which is a beautiful
None
thing.
At all.
It's kind of got, I guess, Barry McKenzie, you mentioned last time, there's a little bit of the same thing of being over in the UK, and the wildest and most creative, or many of the wildest and most creative people in London in the 70s, as we know, were from down under.
Yeah, oh, to be an Australian in London in the 70s. There was a real gang of us over there that were having a great time, but doing great work. And the Rocky Horror Show, as a small little theatre show, was this phenomenon created by Jim Sharman and Richard O'Brien, and it just ran and ran and ran in this dinky little theater, and then it became this movie that was pretty much kind of a flop on release, and certainly not particularly critically acclaimed on release, but has gone on, as you said, to be just this the most enduring midnight movie, I would say, of all time. I can't think of another film that plays around the world on a weekly basis, and especially with all these people dressing up and singing along and all of that whole thing. You know, other films have done it for a year or even 5 years, but the Rocky Horror Picture Show is from 1975.
Amazing.
And it's still playing at cinemas around Australia and around the world on a weekly basis.
It's not an Australian film, but The Room has a similar audience participation. People haven't seen that. It's fantastically terrible. And it has going for it the fact that someone made a film about the making of The Room because it was so ridiculous. But anyway, if you haven't come across The Room, I love it dearly. Please do go and look at it. But Rocky Horror, yeah, I mean, I've seen it on stage a number of times. It gets remounted regularly on Australian stages, always with great fanfare. And yeah, I mean, it's quite bizarre because these days when you look at it, it doesn't seem hugely transgressive simply because we now live in the world that Rocky Horror and others created. But back then in the 70s, it must have been hugely out there, CJ.
I think it would have been, you know, from the opening number or from the second number with the arrival of Dr. Frankenfurter singing that Sweet Transvestite from Transsexual Transylvania song played by Tim Curry, giving, you know, one of the greatest performances ever committed to celluloid.
Yeah.
I'll just say that, you know, it is just the synthesis of actor and role and movie is just incredible. It's interesting that you say it gets remounted a lot in Australia because I think you're right. I think that it probably gets remounted, the stage show, in Australia more than in the rest of the world, that somehow we have subsumed the show back into our popular culture in a way that other places haven't, because it just, I think it reverberates with an Australian comic and flamboyant sensibility.
Well, there's it's not hard
Richard
to draw
O'Brien
the...
Richard O'Brien is antipodean, and he's New Zealand, so...
It's not that hard to draw a parallel between, you know, Rocky Horror and, for instance, Priscilla, which also has, you know, gone to the theatre as well, having started as a movie. We're talking about films of the 70s here. On Nightlife, Dom Knight filling in for Indira, who's a little bit unwell. Someone's texted in concern as to where she is. She's just not 100% this weekend, so I'm with you. Let's have a listen, though, CJ, to the trailer for Rocky Horror.
You've seen all kinds of movies, but you've never seen anything like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
See the Rocky Horror Picture Show. A different set of jaws. Rated R.
A different set of jaws. That's still quite funny, CJ.
Oh, the whole thing is funny. When you just think of sort of the opening sequence that leads into Time Warp, and just the first time you saw that, you were just thinking, what is going on? This is mind-blowing. This is insane. This is wonderful.
And the parody of the young lovers who I think were always American and thinking that it wasn't made by Americans, it's quite fun. So there you go. That's the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Very worthy inclusion in the list. And I think the people behind it, basically that's all the work they ever had to do. They were living on royalties for the rest of all time, weren't they?
I think it made a lot of money, definitely over the course of time. So did the stage show, by the way. There was a sequel, a kind of semi-sequel, a bit later called Shock Treatment, which Jim Sharman also directed. That was a flop. And Shyamalan's, I mean, he directed some other films. He directed The Night the Prowler, for example, in 78. But his last film was Shock Treatment. It was a flop, and he got out of film after that and just concentrated on theatre. And most of his theatre work has been in Sydney or Melbourne ever since. He's still around. He's still alive.
Yeah. And I mean,
he mainly directs theatre and opera.
I guess it was really theatrical even on screen. And the thing that I hadn't realised going into it when I first watched it, and I first came across the film in detail, actually in high school, one of my fellow students kind of gave a presentation about it because he regularly went to watch it, and he explained this whole experience that you had in the cinema in a way that, you know, that there are all these traditions about what you say when and what you do and actions and so on. And I had no idea, and I really enjoyed it. But Susan Sarandon being in it, who was a huge star, that was a surprise too, the young Susan Sarandon cropping up there. And lots of people have gone on from that too. We do interesting things in later life.
Mm. Although Tim Curry, I think, will never, you know, that's a role that will define him for all time.
Yeah, absolutely. So there you go. What a good place to start. That's the Rocky Horror Picture Show from 1975.
Although not that Australian.
We'll call it. Look, it's something Australian director. We're totally owning
we'll claim it.
I mean, we were discussing last night whether Crowded House Canada is an Australian band, and we think that they did. So we can have a tenuous link. But well, I think most of the rest of the list is a bit more unambiguously Australian. If you've got an addition to the list, someone's done that and said, what about The Last Wave? That was a weirdo film. Do you recall The Last Wave?
Yes. In fact, not only do I recall it, it is on the list. It's from 1977. It's another Peter Weir film. Peter Weir dominates the entire 70s list, really, as well he should. He's probably, to my mind, he's probably Australia's most important director of all. And The Last Wave is terrific. I saw it a long time ago, and I think I saw it on television, so it would have been a bit cut, would have been a bit edited. And I remember it in a very dreamlike way, which is interesting because it's about dreams. It's about a lawyer in Sydney who is having dreams that might be premonitions. And what they might be premonitions of is an apocalyptic rain event / water event. And so the film is like a horror film about rain. And so rewatching it just an hour ago, actually, was
yeah.
the last film, watching it before coming on to talk to you, and watching the first half an hour where it's basically this gradual horror film about more and more rain and like people's leaky houses, it absolutely resonated in a very, very particular, unnerving way.
Gosh.
If you've been on the East Coast over the last 6 months, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
So yeah, I suspect
watch right now would actually creep people out for that reason.
Yeah, don't watch it if you're in Lismore or Brisbane, I don't think, or any of the other places recently affected.
Yeah.
We've got a clip here. Here's a bit of a scene where the lawyer, Richard Chamberlain, is being lectured to by a fellow lawyer about his Indigenous clients. This is from 1977's The Last Wave, directed by Peter Weir.
The judge put them in the hands of his tribal elders. They speared him in the leg 3 times, and that was his punishment.
Yes, well, the tribal law angle might work if you're dealing with tribal people in a tribal area. But we're not. These are city people.
You might be wrong.
Oh, come on, David. Look, I think I've got to dispel a few rather romantic notions you seem to have. Number one, the traditional culture of the Aborigines only survives among full bloods in the far north and in some parts of the desert. The nearest tribal Aborigines live 1,000 miles from Sydney. Number two, the people we call Aborigines in the cities are no different culturally from depressed whites. We destroy their languages, their ceremonies, songs, their dances, and their tribal laws.
So the destructiveness of colonisation featuring in the film there too, CJ. And did that connect to the plot of the environmental destruction?
Oh, absolutely. They're completely intertwined. And one of the things we see in Australian cinema in the 1970s by some of the more thoughtful directors such as Peter Weir and Fred Skepsey, who we'll get to, is wrestling with Australia's colonial history and how it intersects with the Indigenous peoples of Australia. And The Last Wave is doing that. The real world plot has this lawyer character defending four Indigenous men who are accused of a heinous crime. And through his defense of them, he comes more into the realm of the spiritual life of Indigenous Australians and how that might be related to the dreams or premonitions that he's having about the last wave, about this apocalyptic water event. So they are all interconnected, yeah. Now, whether or not, you know, it was up to a white man to be telling that story, I don't know, but this was 1977, you know, and people were finding their way. So, you know, when you look back on the film, it probably steps in some places or in some ways that we wouldn't necessarily if we were making it in 2020. But I think in 1977, I feel its heart is in the right place. Mm. And it's quite a sophisticated and intellectually curious film.
So, yes, as we know, reconciliation happens in steps. But for these issues to be the subject of all these works of art in the 70s, I think reconciliation really is the great theme of Australian culture, popular and high culture. And you know, it's a thing we struggle with most of all. So we start to see this make it into the world of auteur cinema. In the 70s.
And so that's, we have directors not afraid to absolutely engage with it, absolutely.
And speaking of Indigenous themes, we've got a text here from Matt in Monterey saying one of his favourites from this period was Storm Boy from 1976.
Storm Boy isn't on my list for the simple and perhaps shameful reason that I've never actually seen Storm Boy. Have you?
I think I did growing up, but I can't remember much about it. I'm pretty sure that I did, but I mean the extraordinary David Delathnew that we're not calling him. I think are we going back to calling him David Gulpilil? I think
I believe now. So. Yes. Yep. The most recent documentary about him was called "My Name Is Gulpilil." So absolutely.
So he was, you know, that was one of his greatest works of art. So, and he was a big part of the on-screen journey towards reconciliation as well. So glad to get Storm Boy in the mix there. I saw Storm Boy on stage as well. So it's one of those stories that keeps coming back. A book originally as well, of course. So
they did a remake of it like 3 years ago.
That's right. They did too.
They remade the film. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's from 76 and then they remade it in 2019.
Yes. Well, it's. I'm sure it'll come back in the future as well. And the other stage version wasn't long ago either. So good to put Storm Boy in the mix. Thanks for that, Matt. So we jump forward to 77. Let's head back to 76 because we did skip a couple on the list and we don't want to miss The Devil's Playground, CJ.
Yes, The Devil's Playground. Here comes Fred Skepsey or Fred Skepsey with his Devil's Playground from 1976. Now, I watched this a couple of days ago in preparation for our chat because I had never actually seen it. And the reason I'd never seen it was I was always afraid of it. So when I was a kid, it was just obviously a movie not for me. You know, I could tell it was an adult movie. So that, you know, kept it away from me for a couple of decades. And then when I was older, I guess the video cover slash the poster for it was really creepy, was really scary. It was a boy in this sort of religious setting, but it was, along with the name, The Devil's Playground, and the font of those words against this poster, it made it look like a horror film. And so I thought it was a horror film.
Right.
And then more decades passed. Well, I thought, yeah, you know, there's going to be some kind of really spooky, scary thing going on within this world of, you know, cloistered boys studying to be priests, you know, in a seminary situation. Then when I was older again, I thought, oh no, what that's going to be about is it's going to be this harrowing tale of systematic abuse. And so I don't want to see that either. So I kept away from it even longer. And so I finally saw it the other day, and it is none of those things. The only thing I got right was that it is set in a seminary. It is set in a boys' boarding school for boys who have had the calling. They've received the benediction. They have decided, even though they are only boys, that they want to be priests and that therefore they should leave their families and go to a particular boarding school taught by brothers. And that's it. They're on the path and they will just progress along that way and become priests.
I didn't know that was a thing, CJ, that these, that there were special schools, you know, to, for those who've decided early. How interesting.
In the 50s, there certainly were, because as it turns out, The Devil's Playground is set in 1953 or thereabouts, and it is Fred Skepsy's autobiographical story. He went to one of these places. I guess he heard the calling, and so he told his parents, and off he went to one of these places and started. And I guess what he did was he left. Well, of course he did, because he didn't become a priest.
He went to film school rather than anything else, yeah.
And what the film is a lovely, charming coming-of-age story about that, about a young boy who's there because he's had the calling. And at the end, he decides, well, spoiler alert, well, he comes to the realization maybe it won't be for him. History has made the spoiler alert from the director himself. He's played by Simon Burke in an amazing performance from a young man, young boy, really. But along the way, what you think is going to happen, which you think is going to be a story of systemic abuse, I realized that's only because of what's happened since 1976 and the revelations that have come out. But this film's not about that. What this film, it's much more upbeat than that. It shows both the boys and the brothers who look after them and teach them, all of them are wrestling with the fundamental idea that they are all there trying to be celibate.
Is celibacy all, for me? Yes, I can imagine that being the case.
They are all stricken with how ridiculous is this that we're all walking around trying not to think about sex.
Young boys in Catholic school wrestling with their feelings and whether celibacy is really for them, and a journey, CJ, that he went on in his own life, really, and clearly decided not to not to become a priest at the end of it.
Yeah, and it's a very even-handed film because, as I say, it shows these brothers wrestling with their own faith and wrestling with their rules and their strictures. It also shows them drinking an enormous amount and occasionally breaking the rules. So it's got this really Australian quality to it. These brothers are truly Aussies. Like, two of them go to a footy match and then they go to a pub and they sink a lot of beer, you know, and then they go back to the seminary.
It's quite the Devil's Playground. Film. Yeah, the temptation is everywhere.
Everywhere.
All right. Now, looking through the list of the films and the directors, we really have an incredible who's who of the new wave of directors in the 70s who came through and really put Australian film on the map. And we move now to not only Bruce Beresford, but also David Williamson, because it's time to talk about Don's Party.
Yeah. I mean, Bruce Beresford is one of our most prolific directors. He has certainly made an enormous amount of films. And one of the things that's so interesting about his career and his artistry is that he really moves around in subject matter, and he'll do a film about almost anything if the script is good and if it appeals to him and if it's possible to make. So he's got a wide, wide, wide CV, wide and broad and deep. But I have to say that I think my favorite of his films is this relatively small scale film, which is this adaptation of David Williamson's play, which is Don's Party, which is about a group of friends getting together on election night in 1969. And what I think I love about it so much is that I remember my parents doing this. When elections happened, you know, if you're my age, and you were a kid, you remember your parents getting together with all their friends and sitting around the television and drinking and watching the results come in and getting loud. And that is exactly what this movie is. And it's a comedy and it's incredibly funny. It is so, so, so funny. It's got some of the best one-liners, some of the best witty dialogue that I think has ever happened in an Australian film. It's still a blast.
Yeah,
and
still
the
gets
cast
produced.
Is amazing.
The play these days, and I once had a Dom's party on election night, CJ, back
of
in the day.
You to did. Do
the pun. But no, I mean, Did that on May the 21st, got together with friends and watched the results come in. And one of the fascinating things about the movie is that it really deconstructs Australian masculinity. That seems to be the main theme of it. It's for political tragics as well. There are a bunch of Labor supporters who get disappointed by the result on the night. But it's got a kind of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf quality of just everything gets laid out. And some marriages that seemed more stable at the start of the film, by the end, you know, all these demons have come out to dance during the course of a night of socializing, CJ.
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. Like, it is definitely the Aussie bloke that's in David Williamson's targets. All of the women in the film are smarter and more tasteful than all of the men, easily. And the men just get drunker and worse behaved as the night goes on. But boy, they're played by some great Aussie actors. John Hargreaves, Graham Kennedy, Ray Barrett, Graham Blundell, Harold Hopkins. It is such a cast. And then you've got some of terrific women, Veronica Lang, Pat Bishop, Claire Binney, Jenny Drinan. It's just, it's so fun. So much fun.
Am I right in thinking that Graham Kennedy played the kind of sad sack male with the beer stein on a chain around his neck? Because that was just such a hilarious concept for a character in an Australian story. This guy loves his beer so much, he carries a beer mug around his neck.
Gosh, probably. It's been a while since I saw it.
It's been a while since I saw it too, but that wouldn't surprise me.
I remember that
pretty clearly. It's just the beer mug was so pathetic. Yeah, and I think Don tries it on with the young girl who's come along with. And Granger Cooley, what a great name for a character that was for the womanizer in the group. And anyway, no, it's certainly one for the political tragics or really just anyone who wants to look at what dinner parties were like and parties were like in the 70s, because I got the sense certainly that most of the people involved in the film had many nights a lot like Don's party.
Yes, I think so too. It was this whole sort of culture of like everyone arrives with, at the very least, a slab.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That's just for warming up.
Yeah. And then, the ciggies and all that kind of stuff. And it's also, I guess, the period of the sort of sexual revolution kicking off. And there are some people in the group, I can't remember exactly how it all breaks down, but there's people who view themselves as swingers and would like to move things in that direction. But also just one of many, many nights, certainly since the mid-70s, when Labor's hopes have been destroyed. And that was the theme in election after election, not this year, but more often than not, the supporters of Labor had their hopes up, and then on the night, the nation chose the other way.
Yeah. It's got some real zingers in there. And it is, I guess it's, it's fin de secular, or at least fin de decade disillusionment too. It happens on 69, changes in the air.
Mm.
That's going down, and these people all decide, oh, well, let's get whacked and jump in the swimming pool naked.
Yes, a few years. These are the kinds of people who would have been very excited about Whitlam winning eventually. And all these people, just intellectual vanity gets, people's puffed egos get pricked and so on. And it's really fun. No, that one I remember very clearly. I think I only watched the movie version maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but I watched the play growing up and just thought it was fabulous. Williamson eventually made a sequel called Don Parties On, but it never got turned into a film, so maybe it will someday.
That's right. I remember seeing that in Melbourne.
Yeah, there you go. So we're talking about the great films made in Australia in the 1970s. CJ Johnson is our guest here, and it's Nightlife. This is the second half of a conversation about the best films in Australia in the 70s. The first crack at this went so long with Suzanne and CJ that we're doing a second installment tonight. So we won't cover the films mentioned last time, but that leaves us still a great many things to discuss. And let's just take a moment, CJ, to step back and set the scene a bit more. Why was it that this wave of excellent directors, many of whom are still certainly around today and went on to have incredible CVs throughout the 80s and 90s and beyond, why did this all happen in Australia in the 70s? What were the things that drove this explosion of excellent cinema?
I mean, it's hard to say authoritatively, but I guess the dam broke in a way. There had been so little Australian film production leading up to the 1970s that when it started to come, it did come in a big, big wave. And indeed, ultimately, it did become referred to as the Australian New Wave in the same way that we had the French New Wave in the 1960s. These things do come in waves because like-minded people tend to generate curiosity and energy and excitement in other like-minded people. So you see it happen in the United States in the 1970s as well, with the movie brats, with Coppola and De Palma and Lucas and Spielberg and Hal Ashley and Paul Schrader and all of these people. They all sort of get together and they sort of co-incinerate each other. You know, they spark each other on.
Yeah.
And even form a kind of healthy competition. You notice that I am saying a lot of male names. I can't help that. That is history talking. But we will get to a very, very important female director that also emerges in the Australian New Wave. But really, the names that we're talking about over and over again in the 1970s are Fred Skepsey, Bruce Beresford, and Peter Weir. Between the three of them, they totally sort of dominate. And because they're making films every 2 or 3 years each, they can kind of account for pretty much all or most of the great films of the 70s, although we will have a couple of exceptions, obviously.
Yeah, just wondering whether one of the things that may have assisted things was, if I recall, AFTERS, the National Film School, was opened early in the 70s, so certainly some on this list, I think, CJ, went through AFTERS, and maybe it might have been a chicken and an egg thing. Maybe it was the point where, because there was a push to make film in Australia, film school was part of it, or maybe it was the fact that we finally had a film school that meant that people were able to train up and learn the skills. But yeah, it does seem as though really across the world, certainly the English-speaking world, you had these kind of directors seeing themselves as auteurs and expanding the possibilities of cinema throughout the decade, whether you're talking about Australia or indeed places like America.
Well, the other thing is funding. Australia only seriously started to fund its own cinema in the 70s. So that makes all the difference. You know, movies are the most expensive art form and someone needs to pay for them. And outside the Hollywood system or certain money-making studio systems in certain European countries, the rest of the world relies on government funding to make movies. And Australia has always relied on government funding to make movies. We wouldn't make movies without it. And so that sort of kicks in the 70s. And because we have a few acclaimed critical hits that are globally acclaimed early on, with films like Walkabout and Wake in Fright, and then especially by an actual Australian director, Picnic at Hanging Rock in 75, then the government wants to jump in, you know, wants to take credit. So as the films gain kudos at places like Cannes and other places, other festivals around the world, and at box offices around the world, then the Australian government is happy to fund them. So that certainly is what's really driving production. And luckily, we had the directors to back it up, to take the money and make quality product. And it was really, I mean, it's easily the best decade of Australian cinema. I don't think anyone in the world who knows Australian cinema would argue against that.
And CJ, I got so excited talking about Don's Party, I forgot to play any of it. Here's a clip of Bruce Beresford's 1976 film, Don's Party.
Well, when I went to the university, I went there to learn, not to take over the place.
I don't want to sound offensive, but you sound like a young liberal.
Jody is a self-confessed right-winger.
Really? How interesting. I never met anyone who voted liberal in my life. Can't think how they keep winning.
They'll win this one, too.
She needs a good, long, hard talking to, she did.
You hear the TV on in the background there, and she was right as well, CJ. The 69 election was won by the Liberals. So she's in many ways the most informed person at the party when it comes to politics, even though everyone else in the room thought that they knew more.
Just so, that line delivery. I never met anyone who voted Liberal in my life.
Yes. No, it's very fun, Don's Party. If you want to join the conversation, 1-300-800-222. In fact, we've got a call just before we get off Don's Party. Bob's called up. Hello, Bob.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, good. What do you want to add to this conversation about a wonderful film?
Look, I don't know whether people realise, but John Gorton, a former Prime Minister, actually made a cameo appearance playing himself.
Did he?
Yeah.
What did he do? I can't recall. That's very cool.
It's a long time since I've seen it, but I have a feeling it was at the airport or whatever. But I'm confident of that fact that he in fact did play a cameo role playing himself.
You're doing pretty well when you get the Prime Minister to do a cameo in your movie.
Well, he's continuing a good tradition because Gough Whitlam played himself in Barry McKenzie Holds His Own.
That's exactly right, too. Yeah.
Well, the challenge is out to Anthony Albanese. What will he appear in due course?
Oh,
thanks for that.
China Revisited, I would think.
Thanks for that, Bob. There you go. Good to have some trivia there. John Gorton appearing in as well. Yes, and Wikipedia bears that out, but it doesn't exactly say what he was doing, which I'm keen to do. Apparently they wanted to put him in because he helped to re-establish the Australian film industry. So the film industry wanted to thank him in that way.
Jobs for the boys.
Jobs for the boys. Yes, it was the 70s, wasn't it? We move along, though. And I've got a text here about this film. Someone says, hello, I remember seeing and being very moved by the chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. Not sure what year. Well, the year was 1978, CJ Johnson.
Absolutely. I watched this today and I'm so glad I did. This was, once again, one of those films that I was always afraid of as a kid because the poster was scary. It was a bloody axe. And then, of course, if you saw little clips of trailer for the film because it was being screened on television, the trailer was scary to me as a child. And anyway, if I had ever watched on television, it would have been very, very edited because it is a violent movie. It's a brutal movie. It's a very interesting set film. So this is Fred Skepsy again. It's 1978 and it's based on a book by Thomas Keneally, who interestingly plays a brother in The Devil's Playground in 1976.
He would have been perfect for that, having had that experience himself. There you go.
And having the beard.
Yes,
so, right. Yeah. So I don't know whether Fred Skepsy was friends with him and then decided to make a film of his book or why and how that all happened. But The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith is a Thomas Keneally book based on history. It's a historical novel based on events that actually happened. So it's about colonial Australia, and it's set at the time of Federation, right in the months leading up to Federation. So everyone's on edge about Federation, and everyone's also on edge about how Federation will affect the lives of Indigenous Australians. And Jimmy Blacksmith, the title character played by an actor named Tommy Lewis, is a half caste in the terminology of the film and has been sort of taught by a religious couple and is sort of being groomed for essentially white society. But then after a series of indignities, he picks up an axe and then a gun and rebels in the most brutal, violent way. And the second half of the film sees him carrying out a series of brutal murders. He becomes a serial killer of white people. And the film's politics are incredibly interesting because it looks at all sides. On the one hand, Jimmy is rebelling against absolute indignity. And not only that, he at some point declares war and you realize that his fight is the fight to repel the invader, his fight is a fight against all non-Indigenous people to take back his own country. But on the other hand, the very first thing he does is kill women and children. So on a micro level, on an immediate level, his actions are unjustifiable. But on a macro level, you can see what he's doing. So it's really intriguing. And I think time has been very good to it. You know, it's still provocative and thought-provoking, still brutal, but still political, while also being a piece of sort of almost exploitation entertainment, but at the highest level. And it's beautifully shot. It's beautifully made. Fred Skepsis certainly learned a bunch of things between Devil's Playground and Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. The film is widescreen. It's incredibly, the cinematography is amazing. The use of music, the editing is really interesting. The storytelling is really interesting. It's fantastic.
Let's hear a bit of the Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith.
For £2 all you're getting. 12 of them posted 3 inches out. One of them by more than 4 inches.
Not by my rule, boss.
It's my rule that counts.
Well, posts are solid, boss. Rails cut good. Can you give me a reference?
Jesus, you're a fussy bloody black. What you want references for? A job in the bank?
So I can show it to other people who want fences done.
Oh, you haven't got me writing glasses. And I want you off the property by 10 in the morning.
So once again, dealing with the great theme in Australian art of reconciliation and how we deal with the problematic aspects of our history. We're talking about the great films of the 70s here on Nightlife. CJ Johnson with me, Dom Knight. And with only 10 minutes to go, CJ, we've got to cover a few more films. There's it was such a prolific decade. We need to make sure we get onto everything. And we come now to a film that I've never seen but have always wanted to, and I'm keen to get your take on it. It's Newsfront, directed by Philip Noyce.
Yes, I've never properly seen Newsfront either, so we're going to have to glide past this one pretty quick. But I couldn't not put it on the list because I know that it is such a seminal film in the history of Australian cinema and certainly in Australian 1970s cinema, not least of which it is the beginning of Philip Noyce. And Philip Noyce goes on to be a major Australian director, even though a lot of his career actually ends up overseas. You know, Philip Noyce goes to the United States and becomes a big Hollywood director and makes big, big, expensive Hollywood action movies, among other things. But I remember Newsfront being one of those films that was just winning all the awards and was just a huge critical success. And I was a tiny child when it came out, but I guess I was starting to sort of notice these things, you know, be aware of these things. I was aware that in 1978, it won Best Film at the AFI Awards and also won Best Director and also won Best Screenplay and also won Best Actor and won Best Actress in a Supporting Role. And it won some other awards too. I think it won Production Design and Costume Design. And then it was nominated for like all the other awards. So I remember that being like, oh, this is that film, you know, this is the kind of film that sweeps all the awards. And I guess kind of got me interested in the AFIs and so on and so forth. So it's a film I have to see. A lot of these films are kind of difficult to see. But luckily, Newsfront was finally released on DVD in 2016.
Gosh.
Even though it was made in 1978. And thank goodness it did get a release on DVD in 2016, because it is the fate of a lot of Australian films that they haven't been properly archived, let alone restored. You know, they haven't just been properly saved. And, you know, one of the ways to do that these days, well, the way to do it is to create a digital version of it that then can be available. One of the films we talked about last time, Wake and Fright, was thought missing. We didn't talk about this last time, so we can talk about it right now. It was thought missing forever. It was thought to be a lost film. And this is a film from 1971 that went to Cannes. And then luckily a print was found in the basement of a university somewhere in the United States. And it was shown once at the Chevelle Cinema. And I was at that screening, and then they took it away and they restored it and digitized it. And now you can get, you know, Wake and Fright is a hugely popular digital film, but it was thought to be lost forever.
But there's, you know, the streaming world, and even the digital pay-per-view world, is there's much less available than there was in the DVD era. So we need to, as a national priority, you think the Film and Sound Archive needs to preserve all these things and find a way to make them available, because if you want to watch the classic movies of the 70s, I bet it's quite hard to track many of these down even today. So let's hear a bit of Newsfront. This is Brian Brown, the great Brian Brown, playing an editor in the newsroom.
The Prime Minister has recently called a referendum. asking for a constitutional amendment enabling the government to outlaw communism and imprison any person two cabinet ministers together declare to be communist. This, in Dr. Evatt's view, would give the ministers police state powers, powers comparable with those of... I thought I told you to take that out.
It's in, Ken. Can we back up to the head?
I'm not going to say it.
It's still in, Ken. AG reckons it's fair comment.
Is that so? Well, convey to AG my resignation. Effective as of this moment.
Oh, come on.
And remind him he owes me £3.
I warned you.
Look, it's not as though you've got to say something that isn't true.
And what's that got to do with the fact that I'm not going to say it?
It's got everything to do with the fact that it should be said.
Listen, mate. I depend on government bodies like the ABC for half my daily bread. And I'm not calling any government that pays me as well as these buggers do a police state.
What does a newsreel announcer sound like off the camera? Sounds like that. That's great. We've only got a few minutes left. CJ, let's pay tribute to my brilliant career. Now, Gillian Armstrong, one of the great directors of Australian cinematic history.
Gillian Armstrong emerges in 1979 with My Brilliant Career and forges her own brilliant career and the brilliant career of Judy Davis, who is playing Miles Franklin. So it is a seminal work of Australian cinema, of feminist cinema, and of, you know, the birth of a particular one of Australia's great actresses and one of Australia's preeminent female director, I would suggest, in Gillian Armstrong. You've also got Sam Neill in there, young, handsome, devilishly handsome Sam Neill, and a terrific movie, a beloved movie, one of those films that I think a lot of Australians hold true to their heart. I understand that Judy Davis is not a fan of it.
I saw
an interview with her where she had a difficult time on the film. I think she and Gillian Armstrong had a bit of a difficult time. And I think Judy Davis had to sort of find her voice and her vocation, like on set, like straight out of acting school, straight out of NIDA, I think, and found it kind of tricky and is kind of resents or regrets being defined by the role. But regardless, she gave one of the great performances in Australian cinema. So
yeah, I watched this in a form of film school myself, CJ. It's terrific.
We have to get on to Mad Max, though.
We will. We'll get on to Mad Max. And I'm going to play a bit of the trailer to Mad Max. And what a perfect place to finish this conversation.
Max is a cop. One of the best.
Where does the rat to get you?
Scoot junkies?
Yeah, nomad trash.
Toe Cutter is a glory roader. One of the most sadistic.
Anything I say. Anything you say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
But only one can have his way. Mad Max, the maximum force of the future.
Incredible that a film from 1979 still has sequels being made today.
Yeah, I mean, they're shooting Furiosa at the moment.
Exactly.
Which is the prequel to Mad Max Fury Road, which is essentially Mad Max 4.
Incredible. So George Miller is one of the greatest two and still going strong today.
George Miller is, he's a visionary. I mean, look at the films that we've had. We've had some really interesting, crazy films like The Cars That Ate Paris. We've had all these reckonings with colonialism and the British invasion and, you know, indigenous themes with Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith and The Devil's Playground. We've had social satire. We've had, we've had historical drama. But then George Miller comes along in 79 and gives us Mad Max and just changes everything. He invents a new genre. he goes punk apocalyptic. I mean, it's just, and especially when he gets into the Road Warrior, you know, the sequels, and takes it further. He just shakes everything up, and it's so refreshing to be able to sort of come to the end of a decade and with something like Mad Max 1979 and being like, yep, this is the start of the next decade. You know, it's a nice bookend to a decade because it is so different from anything that's come before, not only in Australian cinema, but in the history of cinema. It's a great film. Still check it out. It's probably not what you remember if you haven't seen it in a couple of decades because the apocalypse hasn't happened yet. The apocalypse happens between Mad Max and Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. It's just a really dirty, nasty vision of a kind of near future when the gangs have taken over the highways and remember that he's on your side.
I saw it relatively recently, maybe 10 years ago or something like that, there was a screening at that Steve Bisley attended, and they brought the Interceptor car along, and it was some sort of anniversary. It was great fun. What a great way to be indoctrinated into the history of Mad Max. But, I mean, it's imitated so often in the subsequent years, the sort of post-apocalyptic genre. They're still making them today, but they don't, no one does it as well as George Miller.
No one does it like this. You know, he's the only one. He's the granddaddy of the whole thing. And Mad Max also did this other thing, which was it took all these very brave, very foolhardy souls out to wherever with a bunch of these cars and motorbikes, and they just got what they could. It was crazy. It was like the Wild West out there on set. And, you know, I don't want to say that anyone took unnecessary risks, because I'm not going to say that, but I think it's pretty clear if you watch the movie that they were taking crazy risks out there.
I'm sure it was, there were safety professionals on the set back then in 1979. CJ, it's been fascinating. We barely got through it. Bracken Morant says Bill on the Gold Coast in the mix too. We could add to the list as well, but really appreciate your tour through the movies of the 70s. Thanks, CJ.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.